Hebrews chapter 12, about verse 25, approximately. And recall that, like I mentioned last week, this is the writer's last chance, we might say, of trying to encourage the Christians to whom he's writing not to quit. Not to quit. Because, I mean, from about chapter 2 on, he's encouraged and exhorted and admonished and persuaded these Christians by giving them a host of reasons not to quit, not to give up. Some of them probably were having a lot of persecution. Some of them were suffering. Some of them wanted to go back to Judaism because it looked safe and comfortable. And so there were a variety of reasons these people were wanting to quit the church, quit the faith. And so he has repeatedly, over and over and over again, and then this is his last time to do so before he finishes the letter, to tell them why they shouldn't quit. Because what they have is the best. They have the best high priest, the best promises, the best hope. All of these things they have are the very best. So if you have the best, why would you leave the best to go to something that's inferior? Well, that's what he's been telling them. He talked about in verses 18 through 24, he mentioned some of those things about God, the judge of all, the spirits have just been made perfect, Jesus, our mediator. Just a number of things that show this covenant, he says, is the one from Mount Zion, is so much better than the covenant from Mount Sinai, which is where the law of Moses was given to Moses. So it says, this is just better, 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 better. So don't go back to what's inferior. So he says in verse 25, see that you do not refuse him who speaks. It says, don't neglect, don't reject the one who's speaking to you. Now he gives an example of what will happen. For if they did not escape who refused him who spoke on earth, talking again about what happened during the time of the law of Moses, much more shall we not escape if we turn away from him who speaks from heaven. See, they, again, that was an inferior covenant to what we have. Moses was their mediator, was their lawgiver. Christ is ours. And he says, look at how much better Christ is than Moses in every respect. We have it better. Everything is better with the new covenant, with the gospel age, with the church age. Everything is better. He says, whose voice then shook the earth? Mount Sinai, you go back to Exodus and read about what happened when God spoke from heaven. The actual physical earth where they were shook. The people were terrified. I mentioned last week or the week before that there was thunder and lightning and fire, and the people were terrified. The people were terrified. The earth was shaking as if it was a bad earthquake. So see here, he's reminding them of what happened years ago when God spoke on Mount Sinai. He says the earth shook. But now he says he has promised, talking about God, saying, yet once more I shake not only the earth but also heaven. Of course, that's going to happen at the end of time. The end of time, it's all going to be destroyed. Let's go to 2 Peter chapter 3. And we'll see what he's referring to there. 2 Peter chapter 3. (Clears throat) First of all, notice verse 7. If someone would read that for us. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 7.
But by his word, the present heavens and earth are being reserved for fire, kept for the day of judgment and destruction of ungodly men.
He says they're being preserved now until the day of judgment. Until the day of judgment. And then they're going to be destroyed. See, verse 10. The day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise. And the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. And he talks of verse 12. The heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. All of these things, he said, at the end of time, God's going to shake the earth and the heavens one more time, and then that's going to be the end of it. There's not going to be any more heavens and earth. It's all going to be completely destroyed. Whenever God says, this is the end, then that's the end. He's going to destroy it. And it's up to Him. So He says, once more, it's going to happen. Notice verse 27. Now this, yet once more, indicates the removal of those things that are being shaken. The heavens and the earth, this world we live in, and all the stars and the planets and everything, as if things that are made, that the things which cannot be shaken may remain. See, our spiritual home in heaven, that's going to remain. But all this other, this world, this earth, and the what we call the skies, those heavens, it's all going to be destroyed. It's like he says here, it's all going to be destroyed, as he says, removed. It's simply not going to be here anymore. But he says there are some things that's going to remain, and of course that's God's home, heaven, that's going to remain. So he says, therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us have grace by which we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear, for our God is a consuming fire. Our God is a consuming fire. So he says, we're receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken. See, the church, that spiritual kingdom, is not going to be destroyed. It's not going to be dissolved, removed. It will remain. We will remain, because that's what the church is. It's us. So, it's not going to be shaken. So he says, because of that, since the church is going to remain, God's people will remain, the faithful will remain, he says, let us have grace. Let us be grateful. Let us be thankful for that very thing. That's one thing we don't have enough in the church is thankfulness and gratitude. Because we do live in the best of times. When we're talking about the three ages, the patriarchal period, the mosaical period, and the gospel or the Christian period, this is the best period. So we should be very grateful, very thankful for that. And because of that, we should serve God acceptably, which means we can serve God unacceptably. There's no point in Him putting the word acceptably there unless there's a way to serve Him unacceptably. So He says, let's serve Him with reverence and godly fear. Reverence is a respect. We should be in awe of God, of who He is. Would someone read Psalms 89, verse 7? Psalms 89, verse 7.
God is greatly to be feared in the assembly of the saints, and to be had in reverence for all of them that are about Him.
All right, there's that respect, there's the reverence. We're talking about worship today in our sermon, and when we assemble to worship, it's not supposed to be like a party. We're supposed to show reverence. We're supposed to show respect. So he says, serve him with reverence and godly fear. Not just fear, but godly fear. This is an acknowledgement of the fact that God is the only one who has the ability to destroy both body and soul in hell. Remember Jesus' words? You know, don't fear men, because all they can do is destroy your body. But he says, fear him who is able to destroy both body and soul. So, this is how God is depicted here. He ends up by saying, our God is a consuming fire. There's two very different aspects of God, both of which are from the Bible. He's full of mercy and compassion and love, but he's also full of holiness and justice. And so those are both part of who God is. He's both. He's not just one or just the other, but he's both. And so here he's stressing the fact that he's a holy God and one who is just. But I want him to be just. I want him to be just. I wouldn't want God to allow everyone into heaven. I wouldn't want to be in heaven with Hitler. I wouldn't want to be there with them. Because it wouldn't be just. It wouldn't be right. So there is that, those two aspects of God. You know, his justice, but also his love. Of course, without his love, nobody would be in heaven. Period. But his justice is the part that it says not everyone is going to be in heaven. So when you put it together, then you see from the Bible, when Jesus says, narrow is the way, straight is the gate, and only a few go by it. There wouldn't be anybody going by it if it wasn't for God's love and mercy. It would be a completely empty road. But his love allows those who, by faith, obey him. So that's the two aspects of God. His love and compassion, his holiness, and his justice. And here the writer is focusing on, in this verse, his justice. Is that a comment? Don't put your hand up. I mean, I'm going to call it, if it's even like this. I'm going to see it. Okay. Now, chapter 13 is quite different than the rest of the book. The chapter 13, especially the last half, he kind of... when we write letters, you know how we kind of end letters sometimes. Well, that's what he's doing here, too. He gives some... just some general principles, exhortations that are helpful for us to remain faithful. The first one he says, let brotherly love continue. Let it continue. I would imagine that with the suffering and persecution that some of these people were going through, they were probably neglecting this somewhat. And that's pretty common, isn't it? When we're going through difficult times, it's difficult to think about other people. And that may be why he starts this by saying, let brotherly love continue. Because it's easy to forget about the needs of other people when you're having so many difficulties yourself. So he says, you need to continue to have this affection, this warmth for each other. It'll be good for you. It'll be good for them. So don't ignore this aspect. This word brotherly love, this is the word we get Philadelphia from. And, you know, it's the city of brotherly love. Well, that's where the word comes from, this Greek word that's used here. Let brotherly love continue. And there's so many places, and especially in the New Testament, that talk about, you know, be kindly affectionate to one another, be kind to one another, again, show brotherly love to one another. Over and over again, we're admonished to show this type of brotherly love to one another. Over and over and over again. It's something that is important and necessary. He says right along with that, don't forget to entertain strangers. So even ones you don't know. Because he says, for by so doing, some have unwittingly entertained angels. No doubt he's referring to cases like Abraham. You know, that's what he did back in Genesis 18. Entertained people who were angels. But by offering hospitality and kindness and love to people that we don't even know, we are, and kind of in a way, we're showing that to God Himself. Because we don't know who these people are. I remember, and I've used this example before, but when we lived in Jonesboro, Arkansas, the church we worshiped with there, one of the deacons, his wife, for me, was always the very best example of this. She, I don't remember how many kids they had. I think they had 3 or 4 kids. They kind of lived right in the middle of Jonesboro. And you might go over to visit them and you would have no idea. She might have somebody she was talking to that was in need of help, and they would be living with them for a while. Didn't know them from Adam. And she did this. We were there for, 5 years? And she did that the whole time we were there. She was constantly having strangers that she was showing hospitality to. All the time. Never met anybody like her in that respect. But she did it all the time. But that's what she was doing. She was showing hospitality, brotherly love to people she didn't even know. Just strangers. So he says, that's something that's going to help you remain faithful, is to remember to show this warmth and affection to other people. So be hospitable. And especially in the first century, you know, they didn't have the accommodations that we have. Even, you know, they had inns, but they didn't have good reputations in the first century. They were not good places to stay. So when someone would travel, like when the Jewish men had to go to the 3 times of Jerusalem, well, there weren't going to be inns for them to stay with. So they needed to have brethren in Jerusalem or the surrounding areas that would open up their homes for that very reason. So it was an important thing for them to do. He also says there's another exhortation that's to help them. Remember the prisoners, as if chained with them, those who are mistreated, since you yourselves are in the body also. So here's a different group. Those who are suffering, those who are being persecuted, those who are being oppressed, whomever. He says, show compassion for them. And when he says remember, he doesn't mean just to think about them. You know, do what you can for them, whatever that is. Let's go to back to Matthew 25 for a moment, to something Jesus said. It goes right along with this passage. Matthew 25. This is Jesus talking to the people, and he says in verse 36, he says, I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. Then, verse 40, and the king will answer and say to them, assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. So when they clothed somebody, it was like clothing Jesus. When they visited somebody, it was like visiting Jesus. When they went to see somebody in prison, it was like seeing Jesus in prison. So when the writer here in Hebrews talks about remember the prisoners, he says, remember that you yourselves are in the body also. You might someday be the one that's persecuted or suffering or needing clothing or needing visiting, or you might be in prison yourself. So remember that you're in the body also, and that while you may not need it now, you may need it someday. So when you can do it, do it. And then when you can't, someone may do that for you. Then there's another thing he says that's important. He says, marriage is honorable among all and the bed undefiled. But fornicators and adulterers God will judge. Of course, marriage comes from God. He's the one that instituted it. So we know that it's a good thing when it's done right. When it's done right. And that's the difference. It takes two people to make it right. And if only one of the people is doing what they're supposed to do, it's not going to be a right marriage. So he says, when it is done right, it's honorable. It's a great thing. It's a thing of honor. And the bed undefiled, because he says that's where it's supposed to happen. But he says it's not supposed to be for fornicators and adulterers. Why? Because God is going to judge them. I mean, God has a law for marriage. Jesus stated it, and the other writers in the New Testament stated it. Paul stated it. So we know what God's law is. God's going to judge fornicators and adulterers. Then there's another thing he says, verse 5. Let your conduct be without covetousness. Now he talks about something very different. Be content with such things as you have. For he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? You know, the love of money is not supposed to control us. We have to have money. You know, we have to buy food, and we have to have shelter over our heads, and we have to, you know, we have to have it. But the love of money can become sin, he says. He says, let your life be devoid of coveting. He says, that's not how you're supposed to live. So if we turn back a few pages to 1 Timothy 6, at the end of that first letter, Paul writes to Timothy, in verse 6 of 1 Timothy 6, he says, now godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world, and it's certainly we can carry nothing out. And having food and clothing with these, we shall be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness, and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. He says it's not sinful to be rich. It's sinful for you to covet and be greedy to become rich. So it's in all how you become rich that's the problem. So we have to stay away from greed. We have to stay away from coveting. We have to stay away from not being content, all of those things. We have to have confidence, he says, in God's providence. That's what he's talking about here. We have to have confidence in God's providence that, he says, I will never leave you nor forsake you. That's what we have to have confidence in, that that's exactly what he's going to do. He will be there. Never says we're going to be rich, though. Never promises, you know, great wealth. You know, a lot of religions today do that. The name it, claim it people and the prosperity gospel people and all those claim that if you do what God says, God's going to make you rich. Now, that's not found in a single verse anywhere in the Bible. But people want to hear that. That'd be a good thing to hear. It's just not true. But you hear it a lot. Well, our time is up. Why don't we stop there? And Lord willing, we'll start with verse 7 next week.